the next part here, we are going to do, we're going to take this session and look at several kind of just key moments in Israel's history. We're going to really move the plot along and more give you a framework for how to read other parts of the Old Testament kind of in a larger structure than necessarily cover everything or key parts. There are huge parts we're going to speed through or skip altogether. But hopefully this will give you a framework as you read on your own. You would think by this point, as where Israel is at, coming off of Mount Sinai, understanding the law and the tabernacle, and all of that, what they've been through, that the Israelites would just have this incredible trust in a God like this, who has proven himself so fully to them. He's displayed incredible power in getting them out of Egypt, if you're just looking at this generation. He's shown his faithfulness by supplying all of their needs, including food in the wilderness. And he's also shown them his holiness, and in a real tangible way, the seriousness of the power and holiness that he has through the trembling Mount Sinai, through the law, through the tabernacle. But the sad thing is, as you look at Israel's history, especially if you've been around, around the church culture, you'll have seen over and over, there's a history of failure after failure after failure to trust God and follow God. But before we point the finger at Israel and think how terrible it was that they kept doing this, we need to realize that Israel is really just a picture of normal humanity. And if we were in their position, we would most likely have done the same thing, because we also share the same sinful nature that they have. Later in the New Testament, even, we learn that God intends to use the failures of the nation of Israel as a negative example to show the rest of us what we're really like. 1 Corinthians 10 covers this. 1 Corinthians 10 says that these things were written for our learning so that we won't fall into the same unbelieving patterns that Israel fell into. So God allowed some of Israel's history to be captured for us to learn from. And that's what we're really going to do. We're going to look now at some of these patterns and try to learn from them as we kind of touch down on some highlights in Israel's history. So starting at Mount Sinai, which is in Exodus chapter 32 in your Bible, we're going to look at what happened. So we pick up where we left off in the story. So while Moses is up on the mountain getting the law, getting the tablets that have the law inscribed on them, there's an important event that happened. At that point, the people of Israel are still down at the base of the mountain. And they had seen the smoke and the fire, and they had heard the thunder. But Moses had actually been gone for a really long time. The Bible tells us it was about 40 days. And so the people began to lose some patience, and they may have even thought that he had died on the mountain. And so they get restless. Look at verse 1 in Exodus 32. When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, "Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this man Moses, who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him." And so here we see failure in Israel right away, even before the law comes off the mountain. And the failure was worshiping false gods. So if you're filling out your outline, false gods goes in that first blank. As soon as they took their eyes off of God's instructions and off of God's goodness, they start making plans of their own. And Aaron helps them to create a golden calf, an idol, and they worship it. It actually breaks the first two commandments right there at Mount Sinai, before Moses gets down from the mountain. In verse 4, they say, "Here are your gods who delivered you from Egypt." Which, of course, this calf did not deliver them from Egypt. I don't know why they deceived themselves like that. And then they kicked off one long bender, one long giant party that seemed to have lasted for days. It says they got up and just ate and continued in revelry again and again. Well, punishment came for their sin, and when Moses finally came down from the mountain, he had in his hands these stone tablets with the law carved on them. And when he saw the golden calf and them worshiping, he was furious and he threw these tablets down and broke them. And so, and we'll go on, but the blank you want to fill in is death by sword. Oh, you'll get to that. So here we go. So he throws down the tablets, and if you've seen the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, probably look just like that. I don't know. If you're younger and you never saw that movie, it's okay. So anyway, Moses is really mad at the Israelites for having betrayed God in this way. But also, in a way, if you look at the picture, the Old Testament law, like we said, was a covenant. It was a contract, and it was the kind of contract where if you broke any part of it, the whole thing was nullified. And so breaking the tablets was a visual that the contract had been broken. And since the law had been broken, the penalty or punishment for their sin was death. And they'd all worshiped this golden calf, and they all deserved death. And yet God showed mercy. And we're going to see this pattern of failure and punishment and mercy in several of these examples we'll look at. But here God shows mercy because most of them were actually spared from immediate death. Because of his great mercy, God didn't wipe them all out right then. Moses asked God, he pleaded for God to spare them, and God did. He spared them. He actually sent a few people through to kill a subset of the people. 3,000 people died, and God, instead of killing them all, showed mercy. He reminded everyone, though, even while showing mercy, that there is a severity to sin, and breaking this new contract really would earn the penalties that it described, even death, when they broke God's law. Even if it was delayed a little bit, the penalty was still there. And if we look at these lessons as a way for us to learn, I think the application for us looks like this. So many times in our culture, people will think that God is distant, or even maybe that he doesn't even pay attention or care about sin, especially when you see really wicked things going on and people seeming to get away with it. It's a common thought. But God actually is just. He is a God of justice. And that means that all sin does really earn a penalty, even if it doesn't look like people are getting what they deserve. God does ultimately punish all sin through his justice. Like we were saying, though, God isn't cruel when he punishes. It's not out of cruelty. He's punishing with a punishment that always fits what is earned by the sin. And even if it feels like people are getting away with sin sometimes, sooner or later, in God's timing, God makes sure that what is right and just ultimately occurs, even if it's something that happens when they die. Well, if you keep reading the Bible from here, giving you the kind of this broader framework, the book of Exodus shifts to some of the instructions for the Israelites and their priests on how to worship God and their sacrificial system. And the next book of the Bible is called Leviticus, which goes into more detail on how the people of Israel and the priests were to approach God and worship God. And then after the book of Leviticus, we just made it through a whole book just like that, we find a book called Numbers, and it's not a math book. Numbers continues the story of the Israelites as they leave Mount Sinai, and it describes more of their journey after Egypt. And if we're going to touch down in Numbers chapter 13 to look at another example of how Israel's failure can teach us something. So Numbers 13 is on page 78 in your Element Bible if you're using that one. And this is a scene at a place which was named Kadesh Barnea. And so after leaving Mount Sinai, the Israelites are traveling in the wilderness, and they get all the way up to the border of the Promised Land, the land that had been promised to Abraham that his descendants would one day live in this land. And when they arrive, Moses is told to send 12 men, 12 leaders, 12 spies into the land to figure out what it looked like and how they would best enter that land. And if you think about it, they would have remembered that God had promised to give them this land. That would have been a promise told generation after generation to them. And he had shown them over and over again that he would always fulfill his promises. And he had proved over and over again that he had the power to do miraculous things and overcome things that were seemingly impossible. And yet, here we find another failure. The Israelites refused to trust God. And so trust God is your next blank in letter A. So when the spies went in to the land and they came back, they brought back the scouting report. And the scouting report said there were these giants, literal giants, in the land. And they went through and convinced the Israelites that there was no way they should go into the land that had been promised because they would all be annihilated. They'd just be wiped out. And they were sure that God couldn't overcome those giants. But out of those 12 that were sent in, there were actually two spies who believed God. And they said, let's go. Let's get in there. Let's do it. And they were named Caleb and Joshua. But the people sided with the majority, sided with the 10 who said, we can't go in. And as a result, God decided to punish the whole nation for disbelieving. His punishment was pretty sad. He said that none of the people who disbelieved would be able to go into the land. Only Caleb and Joshua were going to be allowed to enter of the adults. Everyone else who was over 20 years old was going to have to die as the Israelites wandered in the wilderness until they died before the next generation would be allowed to go in to the promised land. That was sin's punishment. So it was death by wandering is the sin's punishment. For 40 years, they are wandering while that generation dies off. God turns them around, and they wander until all of the adults who disbelieved were dead. And yet, God still showed them mercy in that time, and the mercy was he continued to provide manna every day for food and clothing. It actually says that their clothing and their sandals didn't wear out. They wandered around for 40 years, and somehow they didn't wear out. I'm guessing they might have had some athlete's foot from wearing the shoes every day, but I don't know, 40 years? But so there's an application for us, though, in this one scene that's pretty sobering. Because of their sin, the Israelites had to live with the consequences. And just like that, when we choose to sin, there are usually consequences that we have to live with. One of the consequences for Israel was that they missed out on being the generation that would get to enter the land that God had promised to them for generations. God still forgave them as they trusted in the coming deliverer to be their substitute payment for their sins, and they went through the ceremonial rituals that pointed to that coming forgiveness. So they were forgiven, and God still accomplished his mission in the next generation. He actually did get the Israelites into the promised land like he said he would. But the generation that refused to believe him missed out on the blessing of being used by God to accomplish his mission. And I think in the same way, when we sin, God still offers us forgiveness through the same deliverer. And yet there are often times when our sin has significant earthly consequences. And that's why I think that 1 Corinthians 10 passage says that this is why these events are recorded for us, so that we'll appreciate the consequences of sin and the tragedy of sin, and hopefully we'll learn from Israel's pain and avoid sinning and some of the pain that comes with it in this life. Okay, so that's a little heavy, but it's a good FOMO if you are afraid of missing out on God's mission. All right. So this isn't the last time Israel repeats this pattern. Let's jump a little bit further in the book of Numbers to chapter 21. So during these years of wandering, there comes this point where there's a king in this land called Canaan. And he found the Israelites traveling, and he attacks them, and he takes hostages. And God empowers the Israelites to go chase after this king and conquer some towns and cities of this king's and gives them this great victory. But shortly after that, the Israelites shift back into grumbling and complaining, even though God gave them this victory and gave them his people, their people back. Read in verse 4, Numbers chapter 21, verse 4 with me. This is they, the Israelites, are following Moses. They traveled from Mount Or along the route to the Red Sea to go around Edom, which just means they had to kind of take the long way. But the people grew impatient on the way. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the desert? There's no bread, there's no water, and we detest this miserable food." Then the Lord sent venomous snakes among them. They bit the people, and many Israelites died. The people came to Moses and said, "We sinned when we spoke against the Lord and against you. Pray that the Lord will take these snakes away from us." So Moses prayed for the people. The Lord said to Moses, "Make a snake and put it up on a pole. Anyone who is bitten can look at it and live." So Moses made a bronze snake and put it up on a pole, and then anyone who was bitten by a snake and looked at the bronze snake lived. So let's unpack. The failure here is really grumbling and accusing. The Israelites, fill those blanks in, the grumbling and accusing. The Israelites complain against God, and they complain against Moses, who is the leader that he put in place, and they blame both of them for taking them out of Egypt so they would just die in the wilderness. And so they're asking this rhetorical question: why'd you bring us out of Egypt to die in the desert? There's no bread, there's no water, and we hate this food. And it's kind of crazy when you think about it, because they're getting food every day from God. And they've been given water. They've been given what they need to live graciously. They just didn't like the way God was providing for them. They wanted him to provide a different way. And unfortunately, because of their sin against God and against Moses, they face punishment. Punishment for sin, in this case, is death by poisonous snakes. So you can fill that in. Death by poisonous snakes. A punishment is still death for sin. And God, in this case, uses poisonous snakes to bring justice. So the people start dropping like flies and dying, and they're panicking. And so they come to Moses, and they confess their sin, and they ask him to pray to God for them. And wouldn't you like to kind of rub it in a little bit to them? If you were Moses, if you put yourself in his shoes, they've been cursing you for all these things you've been doing for them, and especially in this moment, and you're the boss, they've accused you of being a bad leader, but all of a sudden they hit trouble, and now they want your help. I think it's amazing that Moses is humble enough to stop and pray to God for the people instead of just saying, "I'm done." Because God is good, God shows mercy, and his mercy is that he provides this serpent on the pole, which is your next blank. He provides this way out through the serpent on the pole, showing mercy to the Israelites when they really didn't deserve it. And this is a beautiful picture for us to learn from if we look at it from that lens. There are even some clues for this unfolding mystery and for this Redeemer that we want to kind of capture here. This is a real story, and it really happened, but it gives us this vivid image of what has to happen in order for a person to be saved. These people are in this awful predicament. The penalty that God had sent upon them for their sin was death, right? They are sitting there. They've been bitten by a poisonous snake. They see the guy next to them is already dead because the venom's taken its toll, and yet there's nothing that they can do to save themselves. And this is how God prepares people for his salvation. You have to first see your need for rescue and your helplessness. And notice this, that while they're dying, they are not told to do a bunch of things that might make sense. They weren't told to crush leaves or herbs and make some ointment. They weren't told to find the right essential oils to get rid of the venom. They weren't told to help others who were wounded in order to get some relief for themselves, to kind of buy down their penalty. They weren't told to fight the serpents themselves or even to make an offering to the serpent on the pole. God actually didn't ask for any payment from them in return for their healing. And really, the same is true for us. There is nothing we can do to save ourselves from sin. We aren't asked to make a payment. Our own remedies won't work. just like it didn't work with Adam and Eve and the fig leaves they tried to cover themselves with, and just like it didn't work with Cain when he tried to approach God through his own efforts, it never works when we try to save ourselves our own way. And I think one piece that just makes this so clear in this story is that the Israelites actually had to look away from anything that they could do. So they couldn't look at where they were bit or where what they were trying to do to make things better. They had to look up to this serpent on a pole, look away to the work of another person on their behalf, the work in this case of Moses, who made that snake. And that is the same way that God's plan of salvation works. It has to be God's plan, accomplished God's way, and even done by God himself. We're going to learn later as we get into the next couple weeks that when the deliverer comes, he's going to be lifted up in a similar way, and people will have to go through this same process in order to be saved. They will have to first see that they are sinners deserving God's judgment, and they'll have to abandon any remedies that they would want to do on their own, and they'll have to look away from their own works to the work of another on their behalf, which is the work of the Redeemer. And as they do, they'll see God's mercy, just like the Israelites were spared, who looked up on the serpent to the serpent on the pole. Well, as bad as this was, the Israelites survived the incident, and they keep wandering, because that's where they're at in history. We pick up with them a little bit later in the book of Joshua. So if you're flipping through your Bible, there's a couple books, and you'll land at the book of Joshua. And it begins at the end of their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. And in Joshua, that book, we find that the people are finally allowed to enter into the promised land. And at this point, Moses and Aaron have both died, who had been leading them. And now Caleb and Joshua, the younger generation, are leading Israel. And the younger generation is allowed to enter. Now, they were assigned, Joshua and the Israelites were actually assigned the task of cleaning house in this new land, in this promised land. And God instructed the Israelites to purge the land of the pagan nations that lived there. And I don't know about you, but have you or anyone you know had a tough time with the fact that God orders the Israelites to wipe out a bunch of countries? I mean, to me, that is actually something I have encountered often with friends who have said, you know, how can a loving God stand there and endorse genocide, even charter the Israelites to commit genocide? It makes them feel like God can't be a loving God like he says he is if this is happening. And so I want to address that objection. Let's look at this situation a little bit more closely. I think it will make more sense as you zoom in instead of just looking at that high-level picture of what's happening. So there's two things we'll have to understand. The first one is the extreme wickedness of the Canaanites. So you'll want to put wickedness in your outline there, extreme wickedness of the Canaanites. So the people in this land of Canaan, the Canaanites, were actually enemies of God. And they were just desperately wicked. For example, it was common practice for them to sacrifice their babies to a god that they worshipped named Molech. Molech was this statue that was made of metal, and they would actually heat it really, really hot, and it had arms that were outstretched, and they would put their babies on this hot metal statue on the arms as a sacrifice, and the baby would die on those arms. And that was a way of worshiping this god. And it was because of that kind of worship, pagan worship to a false god that was actually cruelly destroying people too, that there were other instances of those kinds of things going on in these people. They were opposed to God and worshiping false gods in ways that were just awful. And so it was that extreme wickedness that caused God to want to end those countries, those nations, and the people in them. So the other piece, though, that's important is that God was extremely patient in giving those people, even them as extremely wicked as they were, a lot of time to turn and come back to him. He had actually given them at least 500 years, which began in the time of Abraham with their ancestors, the Amorites. So in Genesis 15, they're actually mentioned, and God is using Israel as an example to them as they kind of see things happening and God doing things in Israel as a way to call them back out of this pagan false god worship to come back to God. And he's given them all of this time, generation after generation, to repent and come back to God. And they don't. They just get more and more wicked and get to this extreme state. And so those are the kinds of people God commissioned the Israelites to kill, to end the evil that they were persisting. And so that's helpful for me in understanding why God would do something like this. He decided to use Israel as his instrument to bring judgment on these nations that were just steeped in sin and evil. And he promised to be with Israel in each of these battles so that they would actually be victorious and that they would actually accomplish what God wanted to accomplish. I think it's also important that we step back and go to what my dad said, remembering that God is holy and that he doesn't take joy in punishing sin. He doesn't take joy in seeing these people die and be their lives ended. He hates sin, and it's a corruption of holiness. And so he can't stand to see it persist. And so that is what causes him to move and destroy the Canaanites. It's really because he's purging and protecting his creation so that it doesn't become completely corrupt or get destroyed by their evilness. All right, so after the Israelites make it into Canaan, then the narrative shifts. And so Joshua is a book about lots of battles in order to clear out the pagan nations. And they have a, you know, maybe an 80% success rate in that. They're not really, you can read about that. But once they're in Canaan and settled, we shift to a book, the book of Judges, which is a book that is capturing part of Israel's history while they were supposed to be under God, actually, as their ruler. Even though there are judges mentioned and leaders mentioned called judges, God was really their primary leader during this period of time. But it actually doesn't really work out that way. The Israelites, when they did trust God and they did what he said, they would win battles, they would stay in a good place, they would be under his blessing. But then when they turned from God and started worshiping other gods or rebelling in other ways, God would send other nations in to defeat them and capture them sometimes. And they would become the slaves of these other countries that they didn't actually wipe out all the way. And then they would cry out for help from God. And he would send temporary deliverers to them called judges. And the judges were not like Judge Judy or other judges that we see today. They were leaders. They were military, sometimes political leaders. They were people like Samson, Gideon, Deborah, Barak, Samuel. There's a bunch of them in there. And they came to rescue Israel from the enemies that had overtaken them and ruled their land. Well, for whatever reason, I mean, we can talk about the reasons, but Israel decides they don't like that structure. They see the countries around them are being led by kings who are, warrior king types that have military and political power. And so they want to have a king themselves. And so the people reject God and demand a king like the other nations. And that should be point B under whatever letter that is. People reject God and demand a king. And God actually knew the reason that they were rejecting the judges as their leaders was because they didn't want God to be their leader. They wanted a human leader instead. And yet, God let them have that request to have a human leader. But he warned them. He warned them that their kings would mistreat them, they would take their money, and their land, and they would take their children and send them off to war. And he gave Israel those warnings, and they said, we're in, we want it anyway. And so their first king was a man named King Saul. And he actually got off to a pretty good start, but then he fell into rebellion against God. And we see the story of the end of the Judges, with Samuel being the last one, and then the start of the Kings happening in a book called 1 Samuel. And Saul's story is in the beginning of that. And then around the middle, King Saul is replaced by another king, King David. And he wasn't perfect either, but in his heart, he desired to follow God. And he becomes an important character. We're not going to spend a lot of time on him, but he's an important character in the overall history. And he was important because the Redeemer we find in 2 Samuel was going to come through David's line, David's lineage. So you can fill out David's line on item 7. The Redeemer's going, God, actually, sorry, let me back up. So God actually one day came to David and told him that the Redeemer was going to come through his ancestors. And here's how it happened. When he was king, David built this wonderful palace in Jerusalem for him to live. But afterwards, he felt bad that he had this beautiful palace and God was still in the tabernacle. He was still living in this tent, this temporary dwelling. And so he wanted to build a house, a temple for the Lord. But when he said he wanted to do that, God said, well, wait, when did I ever say I wanted a house? Why does this matter to you, and who's complaining? And so instead, God told David that he, God, would build a house for David. And by house, he actually meant that he was going to build a kingdom for David. And he also told David that that kingdom would last forever. And that actually meant that the coming Redeemer would come through David's line, the line of the kings that succeeded David, and that this Redeemer would rule forever in that succession. So 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 16 is where we find one of those prophecies. It says, God is talking to David. It says, your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. And so there's no way that could actually be specifically just to David, because it's saying it's going to last forever. And then Isaiah chapter 16, verse 5. Isaiah is a prophet to Israel, and he gives part of this prophecy that is talking about David's kingdom as well. It says, in love, a throne will be established. So in love, a kingdom will be established. In faithfulness, a man will sit on it, one from the house of David, one who in judging seeks justice and speeds the cause of righteousness. And so both of these together are giving us even more clues about this deliverer. They're saying that he's going to come from the family tree of David, and he's going to bring justice, which will mean dealing with sin. And he's going to speed the cause of righteousness, which is really a way of saying he's going to be quick to do what is right. And he'll be a ruler like no other, because he'll actually rule forever. And he will rule in perfect righteousness. All right, so up to this point in human history, right, we are learning a lot about this deliverer. And we know a lot about the plan and the future that's been promised. And God has proven himself through the history of Israel as being faithful for thousands of years. And yet if you keep going through the history of Israel, if you keep reading through, you can read books like 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, and they will capture this cycle that Israel gets stuck in, this cycle of obedience and rebellion. And when the Israelites have a good king who followed the Lord, then they had peace with their enemies, and they had God's blessing. But when they rebelled and turned away, the Lord would send prophets to them. And so you find lots of scrolls from different prophets in the Bible in the Old Testament that are prophets coming to warn them of judgment that's going to come if they don't turn back to God and turn from their sin. And if the people refused to listen to the prophets, then God would send other nations in to fight against them or enslave them. And many times they were taken captive in that history. But then the cycle, they would get to this miserable place and they would turn back to God and he would deliver them from their enemies. and then they would live in blessing for a little while, and then they would go back through the cycle. And we have a tendency to repeat some of that pattern ourselves, if we're honest. But what's interesting is that God never forgot his promise. And even though the nation of Israel often turned back on God, he never forgot his promise that he was going to send that deliverer. He made that unconditional promise to Abraham, and he wasn't going to back down from meeting it. And so as we get further into the story, we'll actually wrap up the Old Testament very briefly next week and then shift to the New Testament next week. So we'll have completed a lot of our high-level survey. And we'll pivot to looking at the New Testament and how it presents a candidate to be this deliverer. And we'll want to remember some of the things that we've been establishing so far because they're going to start to sound really familiar. So there's a little bit of homework to look at a couple of the prophets and things that they have to say, Isaiah and Malachi, and then a passage in Luke that you'll want to possibly read through. And that will be what we cover next time. All right, thanks for hanging in there. We ran a little longer, but appreciate it. If you guys have questions or anything, feel free to catch us after. Let me just pray for us real quick. Lord, I'm so grateful for your word. Thank you that it does teach us, even through counterexamples. Thank you for being so merciful that you allow us to learn from the mistakes of others. And I just pray that you would help us to see the way that your word is such a gift to us, to spare us from suffering and pain that can come from sin. And I just pray you would give us hearts that are soft towards you and that are willing to hear your instruction and to follow it. But Lord, I also just thank you for your faithfulness to the Israelites, your faithfulness to us, and your faithfulness to bring a deliverer that can solve our sin problem. We love you and thank you for all these things. Amen.